Fair warning, this show contains strong language and adult themes from time to time. Sorry, Jerry can't help it.
Sick Boy Wolfgang Productions presents The Offering with Jerry Horror. A deep dive into the history of film and its filmmakers. Mostly horror, always genre.
The term cult film itself refers to the subculture that surrounds underground films and midnight movies. A cafe is usually a small and informal establishment serving various refreshments in an intimate and inviting setting. What do you get when you combine the two? You get the Cult Cafe, located at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington, New York. Every Saturday night at 10 p.m., Cult Cafe brings you the best in cult film and beloved classics, curated with care, especially for a devoted fan base of cinephiles. Cult Cafe is where box office bombs are resurrected, and more obscure, transgressive films, shunned by the mainstream, can find a home beautifully projected on a large silver screen. Past movies screened at the Cult Cafe include David Cronenberg's Videodrome, Frank Henenlotter's Basket Case, John Carpenter's The Thing, Sam Raimi's Evil Dead, Victor Bonacore's Thrust, and Richard Kelly's Donnie Darko. Man, the programming there is on point. For tickets and showtimes, head on over to cinemaartscenter.org to find a listing of films, or add Cult Cafe on Facebook to find a series of upcoming events. There really is nothing like seeing an old favorite in a theater full of your fellow movie fans. Hey, maybe I'll even see you there. Cinema will never die at the Cult Cafe. Welcome to The Offering with Jerry Horror, the show where we can have a quiet and frank discussion as adults about the things that matter to me, or at least that I think matter to me. Please take a moment to subscribe to our show wherever you get fine podcasts, and hey, stay up to date on future episodes. Coming up, the director of The Exorcist and the star of The Godfather decided to team up for an unconventional thriller that was more slasher and less Hitchcock. Originally rated XXX, it didn't look like this film would come to cinemas anytime soon. The film was protested and lauded by the gay community due to its immoral and offensive depictions of gay culture. Theaters were not willing to show the movie because of its dark and sexually provocative nature. The curious case of a gay slasher film that rocked the nation. Ladies and gentlemen, friends beyond the binary, it's me, your host, Jerry Horror, and welcome to The Offering. This episode is dedicated to the memory of William Friedkin. Folks, how are you? How you doing? Are you having it right now? If you're listening and following this show in real time, the leaves are changing outside. Maybe you're having a pumpkin spice latte. I'm not one to judge. I like all that stuff. I enjoy it. I had Monster cereal this year so far, and I got the Monster Mash remix, and it basically kind of tasted like blueberry. So that was not terrible, but also disappointing. And as we reach our autumn years, like myself, we learn that some things can just be a great big disappointment. Been a strange year for movies. That's all I can say. I'll tell you that. Strange year. Who would have thought in the year of our Lord that we'd be watching Chucky on television and we'd be getting a Strangers trilogy? Previous episode. Sick plug. Producer Pete. Hey, we got a really good review. It's on Apple Podcasts. Please go to Apple Podcasts. Go anywhere. Go on YouTube. Just leave a good review. I'll read it. Even if it's crappy. I'll read it on air. So check this out. We encourage the good reviews, though. You know, I'm trying to build a name here. Give me a break. 5 stars. Loving this new season. Jerry's deep dives are second to none. I can't believe how much I learned from each episode. It's insane. Now all I do all day is bother my wife with all of these fun facts. Touché. This was written by Sidhu. So Sidhu, thank you so much for your awesome, awesome review. And I'm so happy that you get to annoy your wife with my nonsense. So, you know, hopefully she stays with you. If not, you can't put this on me. I'm sorry. You know what I'm saying? Whatever you got going on, that's between you and her. Don't bring old Jerry into this. Or bring old Jerry into this. Stay tuned. It's been a crazy year for us with The Offering. This is season 3. And I gotta tell you, man, I am feeling the love. You guys have been so supportive. This success of this season, it's all because of you. We couldn't do this without you guys. And I really appreciate all the kind words, all the DMs, the late night DMs. Jerry, you doing it, baby. You doing it. And I'm like, yeah. So, hey, keep it up. If you keep rocking, we're going to keep rocking. I think that's something that Mark Wahlberg said Dirk Diggler. Yeah, producer Pete, Dirk Diggler. All right, folks. You know, listen, everybody's been coming to this show. They love these stories about my life. They think they're funny. I think this is the funniest part of the show. So today should be no exception. If you like these stories, I'm writing a book. It's going to be really good, I promise. It's just about me growing up in the 90s and all the crazy shit that I used to get into with my friends. And I'm sure you can relate to that. And hopefully it can be a beautiful thing. So, yo, hey, listen, when it's time to drop that book, I'm going to let you know. Things are going good. I am doing well, I can assure you. Started going back to the gym. Been about 6 weeks now. Feel strong. Really watching not just what I eat, but what I'm taking in as far as nutrients and macronutrients. I've crossed that threshold now where, yeah, it's still painful. And I'm, you know, hella sore for the next 2 days after I do a body part or two. But regardless of that, I'm starting to get those good effects. I'm starting to feel more alive, more awakened, so to speak. Seriously, folks, for people who, if you suffer with anxiety, depression, any kind of mental health stuff that I suffer from, you should really get some exercise. It's made a marked improvement on my life in the last 2 months, and I would highly recommend it. Because look, you can't, as much as I love playing video games and watching the inordinate amount of movies that I do, you need to get physical activity. It's good for the brain, it's good for the body, it's good for the soul, and I recommend it. Seriously. A lot of times, you know, you do these things and people are like, well, you know, my ass hurts and blah, 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 blah. But you know what? This is kind of, I'm checking in with you. I'm telling you I'm doing good. I'm doing good. I'm winning. It's been a year, man. It's been a fucking ride. All kinds of stuff has happened to me this year. But you know what? I'm making changes. I'm seeing a therapist. I'm getting help. I am, for the first time in my life, rebuilding myself. It is a painful and awkward process that sucks and it hurts. But you know what? You got to do it. Because this was like, I was telling producer Pete, I was telling Sean, it's like the Dark Knight Rises. Batman gets thrown down into the pit. What does he have to do? He's got to have his spirituality aligned. He's got to have his come to Jesus. He has to come full circle with himself and understand who he is. But the second thing is he's got to make himself strong. He's got to get strong so he can pull himself out of that pit. And why does he have to pull himself out of that pit? So he can go back to Gotham, kick Bane's ass, and take back the city. But he's not just taking back Gotham. He's taking back his very soul. And that is why Christopher Nolan is the OG of that superhero shit. It just doesn't get better. But what I'm telling you, folks, pull yourself up. Get strong. I'm getting strong and I'm pulling myself up from the abyss that is my own sadness and nonsense. Rise above it. Let's do it. This is another William Friedkin joint. Previous episode, sick plug. It was a sequel to a William Friedkin joint, but this isn't all original. Well, it's based on a book. All right, you know what? I'm not going to say anymore. Let's get to it, ladies and gentlemen. Let's go. How do you broach this? Well, I was thinking about this. You got all these movies that were kind of slasher films. It's 79, 80, so it's right around that cycle. I think everything that follows Halloween in 78 takes a cue from it. All the serial killers, Golden State Killer, The Night Stalker, Zodiac, terrorizing entire cities and communities. It's crazy. So it was definitely in the consciousness that these killers were going to haunt our cinemas as well. There was no unequivocal doubt. There was something in the water. Now, I also wanted to breach this with William Friedkin. He just passed recently. He's a cinematic giant. He was a complete genius, perhaps even a psychopath. He was one of these people. He was a wild card. You never knew what this guy was going to say. You got him on an interview. And I will tell you this. No matter what I tell you here today, you need to go and listen or watch an interview with the man himself, William Friedkin. When you watch this man talk, okay, he did a lot of great interviews. You can go on YouTube right now. You can watch 100 hours of this guy and you won't get tired of him. I like that he just didn't give a shit. That's really what I get from Friedkin. And that is the rock and roll rebel, fuck you, anti-authority artists that were being carved out of the stone in the street, you know, in the 1970s. They don't make them like that anymore, kids. They don't make them like that anymore. This is a tough episode for me because I have so much respect for Friedkin as a director. I really do think that he was a maverick, cinematic titan, titan of industry. He brought so much joy to people with his films. I have to start it like this. What's the plot of Cruising? Psychopath is scouring New York City gay clubs. He's viciously slaying homosexuals. Detective Steve Burns, played by Al Pacino, is ordered to don leather attire, hang out at the city's S&M joints, and keep an eye out for the killer. But as Steve becomes immersed in club hopping, he begins to identify with the subculture, maybe more than he expected. Meanwhile, Steve behaves distantly around his girlfriend, Nancy, played by Karen Allen. The police force has this crazy amount of homophobia, and it becomes apparent to Pacino. Well, it also becomes apparent that the killer is still at large.
From William Friedkin.
We've been finding parts of bodies floating in the river.
Comes a psychological thriller.
Why don't we take a walk?
Starring Academy Award winner Al Pacino.
How'd you like to disappear? Go undercover.
Disappear?
The victim was in about 10 pieces.
He's a bad dude. He's a scumbag.
You made me do that.
Where are you?
Things happening to me, you know?
A controversial and landmark film.
Why don't you want me anymore?
What I'm doing is affecting me.
About a New York subculture being terrorized by one of its own.
There's just stuff going down.
You know what you have to do.
Now I'm afraid.
Chapter 1, The Bag Murders. Look, the LGBTQ community has always been under siege. They'd been victimized, bullied, but now they were being systematically hunted. The Bag Murders were a series of murders of six men from 1975 to 1977 in New York City. The nickname originated from the fact that each victim had been dismembered, their remains stuffed in a garbage can and thrown into the Hudson River. The identities of these victims, as well as their killer, have never been established. While examining the clothing left on the body parts, it was determined that all of them had been bought from leather stores in Greenwich Village on the Lower East Side. It was a popular gathering place for gay men during the era. Leather bars, secret bathhouses, and notorious public restrooms. New York City was a much different place in the 1970s. And whatever you came to this city looking for, the city of fear, you would find it. While investigating the murders, a resident of Greenwich Village named Paul Bateson was arrested in September 1977 for the murder of film reporter Addison Verrill. He had written for the New York Post, as a noted film critic. Paul Bateson was thought to be the bag murderer. However, no charges against Bateson were brought into the murders due to lack of evidence, and he was convicted solely of Verrill's murder, receiving a 20-to-life sentence. Now, soon after, a witness named Richard Ryan claimed that Bateson had told him shortly before Verrill's murder that he had also killed three other men. 29-year-old Ronald Cabot, 40-year-old Donald McNiven, and 53-year-old John Beardsley. Each of them had been violently and brutally stabbed to death at their apartments in Lower Manhattan in 1973. The courts could not prove the other murders or that Bateson had any kind of involvement with them, leading many to believe that a second killer was still out there haunting the streets of New York City in the late 70s. Meanwhile, this is where gay politics and culture is at. The gay community's civil rights are completely in danger at this point. It's a scary time for the community. California state legislator John Briggs introduced the referendum Proposition 6. If passed, it would bar gay and lesbian people from teaching in the public school system. And that's insane. That shit would not fly now. But hey, how much has really changed? Luckily, the LGBTQ community, spearheaded by the first openly gay man elected to public office, San Francisco Supervisor Harvey Milk. If you remember, played by Sean Penn in the film Milk. He helped defeat the referendum, which was a huge win for equality. It was a big deal. Harvey Milk had become the hero to a lot of gay Americans. And sadly, on November 27th, 1978, at age 48, Mayor George Moscone and San Francisco Supervisor Harvey Milk were shot and killed in San Francisco City Hall by former Supervisor Dan White. He had been a sergeant in the Army who had fought in Vietnam. He was a former police officer whom served on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Dan White was sentenced to 7 years for both murders. The strangely lenient sentence caused an absolute uproar. It led to the White Night Riots. It was an uprising of thousands of citizens, causing hundreds of thousands of dollars in property damage. There were 100 injuries reported and even 2 deaths. White would serve 5 of 7 years of his prison sentence. On October 21st, 1985, less than 2 years after his release from prison, White killed himself by carbon monoxide poisoning in his garage. Now, throughout the 60s and 70s, the police often conducted raids at places where the LGBTQ community came together, created a big distrust amongst police officers and the gay community. They were often beaten and persecuted just because of who they were. Often, many times, these people were dragged out, beaten, then booked on charges of prostitution, bullshit Mickey Mouse charges in order to just get them locked up in the clink because they were gay. Suffice to say, the gay community was very distrusting of law enforcement, especially after everything that had transpired. Eventually, this led to uprisings against the police, most famously, the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969. Chapter 2, Friedkin's Inspiration. You know, I almost forgot to mention just whom convicted Paul Bateson was. Because this is where things start getting really weird. William Friedkin knew exactly who Paul was. He appeared as a radiological technologist in a scene from his film, the 1973 horror classic, The Exorcist. Friedkin went to visit Paul many times at the Rikers Island Correctional Facility in New York. There was, however, a conversation which suggested that either Bateson had committed the additional bag murders or merely that he was considering confessing to them for a lighter sentence. Bateson would end up doing 24 years in prison. He shortly lived in Freeport, Long Island in the late 90s. And in 2012, a man who fit Paul's description was found in Pennsylvania, and it was discovered at 83 years old, Paul had died of natural causes. Friedkin was enamored and disgusted. He was intrigued. It was haunting his dreams. Somehow, he thought that he had found his next movie. You could say it almost ended up in his lap. It was all incredibly serendipitous. Philip D'Antoni, I'm Italian and I can't say this name. Philip D'Antoni, who had produced Friedkin's 1971 film, The French Connection, he approached Friedkin with the idea of directing a film based on New York Times reporter Gerald Walker's 1970 novel Cruising, about a serial killer targeting New York City's gay community at large. It was all coming together, right there in front of Friedkin, the perfect storm. And the thing was, here's where I'm going to fib. I have skimmed through the 1970 novel Cruising, and it's different because gay culture was evolving so quickly that what's presented in the novel is almost playful and romantic comedy-like compared to what happens with the leather bars and the S&M scene that we see in the final film. All of this was happening in an almost mysterious, phantom-like manner. This film was being manifested even without Friedkin having prior knowledge of some of what was happening. His hand was being forced to make this film. And initially, Friedkin was not particularly interested in the project. In fact, he refused. He felt too close to it because of everything that had transpired between him and Bateson. D'Antoni tried to attach Steven Spielberg soon after. But, and you're not going to believe this, in 1980, Spielberg couldn't get a major studio to greenlight a film about gay serial killer. That was not going to happen. You want to make E.T.? Sure. You want to make, you know, Poltergeist? Whatever you want to do, but just, you can't touch this. Studios, people who knew that Jerry Weintraub, producer, had bought this book, they knew what Cruisin' was, and nobody had any interest in it. Jerry Weintraub, he brings it back to Friedkin a second time. He says, I'm not interested. I don't want to do this. Basically, here we are. Friedkin knew a police officer named Randy Jurgensen who had gone into the same sort of deep cover that Pacino's Steve Burns did to investigate an earlier series of gay murders. All of these factors gave Friedkin the angle that he wanted to pursue in making the film. See, now it's as much as he refused the project, it's coming together. He has no control over it at this point. Jurgensen and Bateson served as film consultants, as did Sonny Grasso, who earlier had consulted Friedkin with the French Connection. And for the record, Jurgensen and Grasso appear in bit parts in the film. You can see them as background extras in a couple of the bar scenes. In his research, Friedkin worked with members of the local mafia, which was then run by the Gambino crime family. Coincidentally, the mafia owned most of the gay bars in New York. The mob gave Friedkin access to a world that he really didn't even know existed. Al Pacino was not Friedkin's first choice for the lead. It was actually Richard Gere. And I'll be honest with you, this is a different movie with Richard Gere, but I think it might have been a better movie. For some reason, I buy Richard Gere in that scene, and there's just a precocious nature to the way that he looks. I think it's a better fit, but I'm playing Monday morning quarterback here, so whatever. Gere had expressed interest, and a strong interest in the part. Friedkin had opened up negotiations with Gere's agent because they had the same agent. So Friedkin believed that Gere would bring an androgynous quality to the role, less masculine, that Al Pacino could not. Now, the negotiations are happening. He's desperately trying to get Gere into the picture. People say to Richard Gere, don't do this. Don't do the gay movie. Don't do it, because if you do the movie, you're going to get pigeonholed. Gere is still a star on the rise at this point in the late 70s, early 80s. He doesn't really begin to find his footing until American Gigolo. Yeah. He doesn't come into his own. And a lot of that is due to the Blondie soundtrack. It's basically a really cool music video. You know, you get to see Richard Gere in really expensive suits driving around with Debbie Harry singing. It works. It's fine. Friends and filmmakers started coming back to Friedkin, and they say to him, listen, Pacino's a better choice. So he took his friend's advice, and he cast him. Believe it or not, that friend was Gene Hackman. Gene Hackman believed that Richard Gere wouldn't be believable enough to the average Joe. So, shout out to Gene Hackman, living his best life. He's retired. God bless him. Scenes from the film would be filmed exclusively at the Hellfire Club and the Mineshaft. Both clubs were famous for the many leather daddies they attracted. Both clubs lured in men who loved bondage and sadomasochism. Pacino hung out at the Mineshaft for quite a few weekends. He got deeper and deeper into the research. In fact, everybody did. Friedkin was at these bars almost every night of the week that he could be. He was getting everybody, Sonny Grasso, all of his technical advisors. They were all hanging out at these bars with him. They were getting deep into the scene. Friedkin said that he was disappointed with Pacino's lack of professionalism during the shoot, claiming that he was often late and didn't add any ideas to the character or the film. It was also believed that Pacino was in the throes of a very nasty cocaine habit throughout the filming. He was completely despondent. It's kind of like an empty shell. And I'll be honest with you, if you watch this film, yes, there is an aloof quality to Steve Burns, the character, but I think a lot of those vacant stares are just somebody coming off the bender of cocaine. I've been there. You know what I'm saying? Like, I know drug use and I can see it. Previous episode, Xanadu, it's like you talk about the film itself, you can feel the cocaine falling off the frame. And that's the case with Cruisin'. That scene, it's there, man. It's the end of disco and it's the beginning of a darker period in American history. Chapter 3, the summer of 1979. Arthur Bell, American journalist, author, and LGBTQ activist. Cruisin' promises to be the most oppressive, ugly, and bigoted look at homosexuality that's ever been presented on the screen. Friedkin is playing with a keg of dynamite, and he's throwing a match on it. I have a suggestion for action, and I implore my readers, gay, straight, liberal, radical, atheist, communist, or whatever, to give Friedkin and his production crew a terrible time if you spot them in your neighborhood this summer. Throughout the summer of 1979, members of New York City's gay community protested against the production of the film. Protests started at the urging of journalist Arthur Bell, whose series of articles, especially the ones about the unsolved murders of gay men, had inspired the film. This was a full-on call to action to the gay community. Cruising would not be welcome in our neighborhoods. Gay people were urged to disrupt filming, and gay-owned businesses to bar the filmmakers from their premises. People attempted to interfere with the shooting, day-to-day shooting. They were pointing mirrors from rooftops to ruin lighting for the scenes, blasting whistles and air horns near locations, playing loud music. Most of the movie is ADR'd because of all these protests. It's so loud. People are doing whatever they can. They're even going to the local businesses and they're saying, hey, look, you know, whatever you're selling, maybe you're selling sandwiches or you're selling ice, don't give them anything. To say that, listen, everything that I've read about this was basically the city of New York, the gay community, tens of thousands of gay men against the production of this movie. Now, usually when you work on a movie in New York, late 70s, you got like three cops on the set. They had to have 300 cops to disperse. There were many times where they were shooting. He was doing a scene in one of the clubs in the Lower East Side, and they were doing a scene with Pacino. Pacino got stuff thrown at him. He got fucking eggs. He got all kinds of stuff thrown at him. But they protested the movie. One night, when they were doing one of the scenes in the mineshaft, they almost had a riot. And they had 300 cops. And they had cops and motorcycles and horses. If any of those gay men knew what was coming, there was a dark specter that was hanging over the city, and they just didn't know yet. Most of the dialogue in this film is completely re-recorded. That's all there is to it. So when you see it, very rarely was any of it recorded on the day. I just want to, you know, for everybody at home keeping score. 1,000 protesters marched through the East Village denouncing the production of the film. They demanded that the city not allow it to be shot, that their permits be revoked. Al Pacino said that he understood the protests, but insisted that upon reading the screenplay, he at never any point felt that the film was anti-gay. He said the leather bars were just a fragment of the gay community, the same way the mafia is a fragment
of Italian-American life. The LGBTQ made every day of this production a living hell. Friedkin had become public enemy number one to the gay community in the summer of 1979. It got so bad. This is how bad it got. How bad did it get, Cherry? It got so bad that Friedkin had to pay the mafia, the Gambino crime family, for protection just so they could get the film done. They had real gangsters with real guns. And if you interfered with the production, they were going to fucking shoot you. And I can't think of anything worse that could have happened if you had one of these wise guys and they shot a gay person. It would have been terrible. It would have sank the movie. There would have been riots. They wouldn't have been able to make the movie. United Artists, the studio behind the film, had executives, the executives start receiving death threats. They say, if you release this film, I'm going to kill your whole fucking family. It's like scary shit, man. They pretty much got scared and they put the movie on the open market. Universal owns the rights now. But this was crazy. It was basically the studio abandoning the project. They put it up like, hey, this is what we paid to produce it. We're going to be very transparent with the costs. And if you'd like to, please buy it because we want nothing to do with it. General Cinema Corporation won a blind bid to distribute the film. With a blind bid, you're buying it based on what you know. Like, okay, well, Friedkin's directing, Pacino's the star. He's a bankable star, you know. Godfather. Okay, this, you know, this looks good. They didn't see the movie, but they bought it. And then upon watching the movie, the executives were so offended by the film, they were calling it pornography. They felt the film should be X-rated and they refused. They said, listen, we own a bunch of cinemas and we're not gonna play Cruising in our movie theaters. It's just not happening. To secure an R rating for Cruising, William Friedkin told Alex Simon for Venice Magazine in 2007 that he had to send the film back to the ratings board of the Motion Picture Association of America 50 times. And when I tell you, there are 40 minutes of this film that are missing, and Lord Almighty, a man gets fisted, and they show it, and there's close-ups and the whole thing. And Friedkin did that purposely. He knew that they would go after the really nasty stuff first. You know, they would go after that stuff that was really just pornography. But yo, Friedkin's hardcore, man. This is a guy, he could go to any studio at this point in time and write his own check, and he's down and dirty in the Lower East Side shooting gay porn, essentially. It is what it is. There's nothing wrong with it. So Friedkin cuts the 40 minutes out of the movie. A lot of it, people say, you know, obviously it just wasn't like wall-to-wall sex. It wasn't like, you know, Cruising was a fucking porno movie and then he cut it all out. No, that's not the case. A lot of it, Friedkin would basically take the actors, and I gotta say, James Remar is in this. Young James Remar, he's so hunky. So hunky in this movie. Who would have known? He's got the long hair, greasy. He's kind of thin, you know. Just remember, James Remar didn't get into Aliens because he got busted for heroin in the UK. That's a crazy little story. Joe Spinell is in this movie. Maniac. He's in the Rocky movies. It's Gaza. Joe Spinell, I mean, I could go on for a whole podcast here, but Spinell was so fucking talented, he could have gone on to do anything. He really was a gifted actor that we lost too soon. So the movie wasn't wall-to-wall pornography. A lot of it was improvisation. Friedkin liked to take his actors and put them in situations and then kind of pull the rug out from under them. That was part of what he did. He wanted to get honesty. He wanted to get a real natural reaction. And I think that's why Pacino looks so aloof. It's not just the cocaine residue. It's the fact that he's being put in situations that he's not prepared for. So that's what he would do. Now, the footage, the 40 minutes that was cut out, it's lost, but it became the inspiration for Interior, Leather Bar, a 2013 film in which directors James Franco and Travis Matthews try to recreate the process of filming Cruising within the New York Leather Bar scene. It's kind of terrible. Don't waste your time. I appreciate what Franco is trying to do with the project, but it's terrible. It's just a lot of improvised bullshit in a fake gay leather bar.
We'll be right back with more of The Offering with Jerry Horror.
You've seen these guys at all the horror shows and comic cons. Now you can get your very own Inked Up merch, the finest in embroidered horror and sci-fi themed merchandise. From Lost Boys to Street Trash, from Chopping Mall to Cobra Kai, Inked Up has the best in embroidered beanies, baseball caps, and patches. Now they've even got their own Jaws-inspired Amity Island board shorts. You gotta take a look. These things are cool. Visit their Etsy store at etsy.com/shop/inkedupmerch. Are you looking to get your own printed or embroidered merch? Inked Up has been in business for over 10 years. Whether you're looking for merch for your band or you need crew logo shirts and hats for your first film production, you need some sick-looking perks for your Kickstarter project, Inked Up can accommodate your needs with their custom silkscreen printing and embroidery services. Visit inkedupmerch.com and tell them Jerry sent you. Insomniacs, join the chat monsters and fellow miscreants of the Midnight Hour for the Gooligans YouTube live stream for a wild night flight of retro commercials, vintage trailers, indie short films, horror comedy, weird music videos, and featuring the occasional Matt Roran appearances. Horror hosted by your favorite funny monsters, the Gooligans, as they stream a live online visual arts magazine and variety television show of the likes rarely ever seen, while also hosting live chat-along viewings of such other horror classic films like Carnival of Souls, House on Haunted Hill, The Brain That Wouldn't Die, The Werewolf of Washington, and one of my favorites, Manos, The Hands of Fate. This is late night television the way you remembered. Subscribe to the Gooligans YouTube channel and make sure to click on that notification bell so that you won't miss the next Gooligans YouTube live stream. Listeners and fans of The Offering can get their hands on their very own The Offering with Jerry Horror merch, now only at Tee Public. Find your own fresh The Offering with Jerry Horror high-quality merchandise, including t-shirts, hoodies, tank tops, long sleeves, stickers, and mugs. Just like the show, we've got gear that's mostly horror, always genre. The Offering with Jerry Horror Tee Public store has everything you need to represent your favorite podcast. Folks, head on over to teepublic.com right now and pick up your very own Offering Tee today. You're listening to The Offering with Jerry Horror. Got a question or a story you want to share with me? It might be featured in a future episode. Email me at jerryhorror@gmail.com or hit me up on Twitter at Jerry Horror. I'm also on Instagram. You can find me there at Jerry Horror. Rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts, and you might find your review in an upcoming episode. And if you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to The Offering. Now back to the show. Chapter 4, The Release. A press release from United Artists. Cruising is a picture we sincerely wish we did not have to show. Variety, 1979. However, due to contractual obligations, they did have to show it. So, can you imagine? This would never happen. I'm telling you, this would never happen in the year of our Lord 2023, where a movie studio would say, we don't even want you to see it. Now, either it's brilliant marketing, or it's the biggest slap in the face that Friedkin could have ever imagined. Same goes for Pacino, you know, because he's carrying the picture. They tried to have a New York premiere for this movie, but they had to do it quietly. So they're having this low-key premiere over in Manhattan. Next thing you know, word gets out that they're premiering the film, and protesters show up to the premiere, and they had to shut the whole thing down. They were just worried about security. There were executives there. There were stars, and people were really not going to go see the premiere because it was one of these things where a lot of the gay community was... they were protesting the film. By association, if you were watching Cruising, you were anti-gay. Cruising was released February 15th of 1980. It's a Valentine's Day movie. In the United States, it had a box office take of $19.8 million. It made money in New York and San Francisco. Those who had protested the film were actually kind of curious to see it because, you know, after a while, if everybody's making a stink about something, hey, you gotta lift the rock up and let's see what's under the rock. For some gay men, it was a rite of passage. It was the first time that they had seen homosexuality depicted in a studio film that was being projected in cinemas across the world. And there, speaking of which, there are corners of the world where this film is completely banned. It didn't come out on Blu-ray in many Arab countries up until 2019. And in fact, it finally premiered. They actually showed it in a theater in Turkey. Films that have to do with homosexuality are not welcome in Turkey. So that was kind of a big win for them. They did have to have security at the screening, which is sad and pathetic. And I sometimes hate this world. Numerous critics at the time had taken issue with its portrayal of gay men. In fact, most of the critics absolutely destroyed Cruising. Critic Vito Russo wrote, "Gays who protested the making of the film maintained that it would show when Pacino recognized his attraction to the homosexual world, he would become psychotic and begin to kill." The second major criticism of the film upon its release came from gay activists who felt that the film had a homophobic political message and that it portrayed gay men as being attracted to violence, which could turn to justify homophobic hate crimes. My man, Roger Ebert, wrote, "The validity of these arguments is questionable at best." And here's a really quick excerpt. He wrote a long review. Here it is. "Here's a movie that's well visualized, that does a riveting job of exploring an authentic subculture, that has a fairly high level of genuine suspense from beginning to end. Then that seems to make a conscious decision to declare itself on its central subject. What does Friedkin finally think his movie is about? 2.5 stars out of 5. And that's always been a problem with this movie. A lot of things are unanswered in this film. There's a very ambiguous quality to it. Even in the last moments of the film, where Al Pacino is looking at himself in the mirror, being changed from his experience in the gay community, and then Karen Allen puts on his shirt and his hat, and I think it's a long gaze. I think it's a man looking inside his own soul, trying to figure out, am I gay? He's questioning his sexuality. And this was something that we did not see on big screens in 1980. It was a big deal. In fact, when they were filming the final shot of the movie, Friedkin refused to give Al Pacino any kind of direction. He just yelled action. And this was actually their last day of shooting, and this really upset Pacino. It put a big rift between them. He hadn't been given any direction. Friedkin said, just go. Pacino would try to say, hey, nope, just go. And that put a big rift, and it was never repaired after that. They would see each other. Friedkin says he thinks that Pacino was kind of a prick and could have done more with the movie. But then Friedkin, because again, he's contrarian. You know, it depends on what day of the week you get old Willie and you're interviewing him. Some interviews, he says Pacino was a prick. Other interviews, he says, I got a brilliant performance out of him. He thinks he's a gem. I'm telling you, go watch the interviews and he'll talk shit about the dude. And then the next interview will tell you how good he was. It's fucking crazy. But that's duality. That's real life. Was Steve Burns gay? Was the character gay? Was he bi? Was he curious? It's all left up to the viewer. It's left up to you, your imagination. It was a mystery. And perhaps it was left up to the viewer to decide who the killer really was. We kind of have, it's not like clear cut, like, oh, this is the killer. We don't know. And with the bag murders, I think a lot of what was going on was that people realized this wasn't one killer. There were multiple killers operating, maybe even two or three. To the gay men in early 1980, that was a scary thing. People also say that Cruising suffers from the armored closet gay trope, where the character who's portrayed as macho or aggressive is secretly gay. And this is not helpful. You know, it's one of these things where this trope is not helpful for furthering the acceptance of gay people, you know. Also released in 1981 was De Palma, Brian De Palma's wildly successful film Dressed to Kill. It featured a transgender murderer, which wasn't exactly sensitive to the community either, and that didn't really help. So you see the gay community right now, they're struggling with how they're being presented in current cinema. And to them, it's offensive and disturbing. And I understand. Believe me, it's not something that I'm ignorant to. Chapter 5, The Legacy of Cruising. Raymond Murray, editor of Images in the Dark, which is an encyclopedia of gay and lesbian films, writes that the film proves to be an entertaining, and for those born too late to enjoy the sexual excesses of pre-AIDS gay life in New York, fascinating, if ridiculous, glimpse into gay life, I'll bet Hollywood's version of gay life. He goes on to say, the film is now a part of queer history and a testament to just how frightened Hollywood treated a disenfranchised minority. In retrospect, Friedkin has said Cruising came out around a time that gay liberation had made enormous strides among the general public. It also came out around the same time that AIDS was given a name. I simply use the background of S&M World to do a murder mystery. It was based on a real case, but the timing of it was difficult because of what was happening to gay people in this country. The AIDS crisis would last longer than any cultural contribution that Cruising had made. The specter of death was no longer a serial killer stalking the streets. It could be anyone. Your friend, your lover, your neighbor. AIDS didn't care, and it would act accordingly. This film has gone on to be hugely, hugely influential. Cruising has an amazing score. A guy named Jack Nitzsche had done all the music. He did not use synthesizers, which was what Friedkin had wanted. He didn't use instruments. This guy had glass, and he would create different sounds by rolling water on the glasses and rhythms, and he would record it and mix it down, and it was all organically created. And I gotta tell you, when you go and you watch this movie and you watch some of those scenes, especially with Pacino in Central Park, and he's trying to hook up with a guy, he's trying to find out what's going on, and there is just, I'm telling you, man, it's just as good as like Bernard Herrmann's score for Psycho. It's so evocative, and it's naturally created. So I gotta say, the score, you know, it's experimental. It's experimental art. You know, people, it's not a traditional movie score, but it works, and it's very effective, especially in a lot of those sequences. Several film directors have cited this movie as among their favorite films. Quentin Tarantino says that when he was doing a play on Broadway in 1995, he had a screening for gay members of the theater community, and it blew their minds. They loved it. A lot of people had never seen it because of the bad word of mouth, but once I exposed a lot of my friends to it, it became one of their favorite movies. Danish film director Nicholas Winding Refn calls the film a masterpiece and among one of Friedkin's best. The Safdie brothers have also named the film as a major influence on their work. The 11th season of American Horror Story pays homage very clearly to Cruising. That whole season owes a lot to Cruising. It's got the vibe. That was also one of my favorites, that 11th season of American Horror Story. Ooh, scary stuff. Scary, scary stuff. Awards. The Golden Raspberries nominated this film for Worst Picture, Worst Director, and Worst Screenplay. And I fucking hate the Golden Raspberries, because like everything they picked, like you know what won? What won that year was The Shining. Like, that won the worst movie. Get the fuck out of here. Home media releases. When they first put Cruising out on VHS and Beta, they put a disclaimer in front of the movie. So now every time that you see the movie, you'll generally see it with the disclaimer. This film is not intended as an indictment on the homosexual world. It is set in one small segment of that world, which is not meant to be representative of the whole. Okay. It's, wow. Just really, it is what it is, man. The Beta was released in 82, along with the film finally coming to VHS in 83. Both were distributed by Warner Brothers, which is where the current rights are now. They bought it as a favor to Friedkin because Friedkin was trying to get his movies. You know, some stuff like French Connection is over at 20th Century. Yeah, it's nice to have the library together. A deluxe collector's edition DVD was released in 2007 and 2008 by Warner Brothers. The DVD includes a very interesting documentary that I recommend. You could probably find it on YouTube. It's called Exercise and Cruising. It'll give you the lowdown on just about everything I've told you. A special edition Blu-ray with a restored print of the film was released by Arrow on August 20th, 2019. It has similar bonus features. It looks beautiful. It's the best the movie's looked. As of March 2023, the film holds a 51% rotten score from critics and a 48% rotten score from audiences. It also holds a 5.1 out of 10 on Metacritic. But does any of that really matter? I mean, over the years, it's been said that many hate crimes committed against gay men were inspired by Cruising. I beg to disagree. I think Cruising brought an ugly truth to cinemas and put it under a microscope. Gay men have always been preyed upon and victimized by a public that didn't want to accept them or understand them. And in some strange, weird way, like a stew or an ambrosia or a jambalaya, Cruising comes together and it means different things to different people. And your mileage may vary depending on where you were at the time. In closing, in 1980, a survey of over 100,000 people was conducted. 46% of the population believed that gays should be penalized and criminally held responsible for their sexuality. Most Americans believed that degenerate behavior, pedophiles, and murder had been linked to homosexuality. It would be against the law to be gay. That's where we were in America in 1980. 46% of the population who will admit to it basically just wanted to either have gays put in prison or murdered. And I got to tell you, folks, it's a fucked up world. And some things change, some things stay the same way. Not for the better. Cruising asks us a very important question. And it made a lot of people uncomfortable with that question. Who am I? Am I gay? Am I straight? Am I bi? Do I have queer tendencies? Am I allowed to find other men attractive? And for most, it was a bridge too far to cross. And quite frankly, it scared people, especially straight men. And that's the question that William Friedkin asks. Who are we? Who are we at the end of the day? Cruising's ambiguous ending hangs on that very question. When Al Pacino looks in the mirror, Karen Allen, she's vying for his attention. Whoever that man is who went to that world and tried to find that killer, he's a different man. And that's the thing about evil in this world. Once you fool around with it, once you meet it, once you dance with the devil in the pale moonlight, as they say, you are forever changed. Folks, this is not an easy one for me. This is probably one of the most difficult episodes that I've ever had to make. I love Cruising. I think it's great. It's a tremendous film. There's a lot of it that's a bit tacky. Some of it's kind of dated. At the end of the day, it's a cultural landmark. It's where we were in 1980. It's what was going on in New York, the party scene. Looking back at it, it seems like a different world. And that's because it was. Some things have changed for the better. Some things have changed for the worst. You know, I'm not split on this movie. Like, I was split on Exorcist 2, The Heretic, where I just don't know how to feel about it, depending on what day it is. But I like Cruising. I like Cruising a lot. There's a lot of great performances in there. The score is fantastic. So obviously, it was kind of really hard for me. I'm like, do we do an unhinged reviews? I'm like, real people have been fucking murdered. And I said to myself, yes, of course, we have to do unhinged reviews because this is very dour and depressing subject matter. I had to do it. I had to get it out of my system. I'm working shit out. Just like these filmmakers like Friedkin, I'm working shit out. I don't know what I'm working out, but we're doing it. Unhinged review. E. Baldwin, verified purchase on Amazon. Title, Ambiguously Gay Al. And this review was written on October 20th, 2007. I was drawn to this film because I was told it wasn't as bad as its reputation suggests and may have been ahead of its time. What time? The Stone Age? Every print of this film should be burned and banned from human consumption. I've never been accused of being a champion of gay rights, but I smell a class action lawsuit here. this flick is seamy and has no socially redeeming qualities. William Friedkin's direction is clueless. Al Pacino is probably, this is probably his worst performance. He seems puzzled on how to play his character. The script is consistently incoherent. The lone saving grace in this film is Paul Sorvino's portrayal of a police captain. Run from this flick if you ever get the urge. It's anti-gay propaganda unfit for anyone. I say destroy every copy. Yet he bought a copy. That's the irony. This is a real review. He didn't give it any stars, just so you know. He was very upset. Here's another one. This was from the Arrow Video website. Antonio, title, not great. Review, just wasn't Pacino's best. Why would you even take the time or energy to put that on a fucking boutique Blu-ray dealer's website? Another one, Brian A., title, one star. Now, this is written in all caps. Terrible movie. I didn't say it was full of gay porn. Okay. Homophobic much? I don't know what, I don't know. Listen, Brian, you got some shit to work out. This was another one. This was from Amazon. Jake H., title, advertising in the film. Review, all caps. Too much advertising. Jack, I couldn't agree more. There is just too much commercialism in film these days. I remember when I was a kid and I watched Superman 2, Channel 7 with Grandma back in the day. And I saw Superman blow up a Marlboro sign with his laser eyes. His X-ray vision. It's not his X-ray vision. There was like laser blasts coming out of his eyes. Yeah, I don't know. It sounds, it's like weird. Like I've never been to this planet before, much like Clark Kent. Yeah, I remember that. It's burned into my mind, that Marlboro sign when he blew it up. So obviously the advertising worked. There's a lot of fucking weird people out there just writing reviews. Why do you even waste your energy? You know, it's like this weekend I got to see Exorcist Believer. And it was okay. I enjoyed it. Kept my, you know, my attention. People were saying, oh, this is the worst movie I've ever seen. I'm like, hold my fucking beer. I'll show you some bad movies. You want bad movies? We've made bad movies. Get the fuck out of here. It is what it is. It's a matter of personal opinion. I think at the end of the day, when this film was being made and when it was released, people were fighting it. The people, you know, that were fighting it, they had their reasons, and I get it. But looking back on it, hindsight being 2020, cruising is just a whodunit. It's just a whodunit. It's a cop drama in a different setting. That's it. At the end of the day, that's really what it is. They wanted to shoot this movie in black and white because they felt that it would help define what Pacino was feeling and seeing. And maybe that his world wasn't black and white, but was gray. And I think that concept scared a lot of people, especially in 1980. You know what? They'll probably remake this, right? No, maybe it's possible. Maybe they'll make a movie about the making of Cruising, because that would be a good movie. Kind of do it like Spike Lee's Summer of Sam. I mean, look, not that I'm giving any ideas out there, but hey, you got a movie that's about the shooting of Cruising while there's an actual killer out on the streets murdering gay men. Not bad, huh? Call William Friedkin. Hey, Pete, you know what I got? A sick plug, because this is the third to last episode of the season. We've done a lot of great movies. Definitely check it out. You can follow me on social media. Don't forget, I'm at Jerry Hara, pretty much every platform known to man. And if I'm not, we will be currently migrating to that new digital streaming, whatever. I don't even know anymore. Everything's so nebulous now. But one thing will never change. The Offering is always here for you. I'm Jerry Hara. This has been The Offering. Mostly Hara, always young. You've been listening to The Offering with Jerry Hara. I'm very sorry. Produced by Pete Bune. If you have a question or a story you want to share with me, we'd love to hear from you. You can email me at jerryhara@gmail.com or hit us up at Twitter @jerryhara or on Instagram @jerryhara. You getting the picture? Subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever fine podcasts are provided for you and your family. I want you to enjoy. Just join us next time for another offering.
This has been a Sick Boy Wolfgang production. Thank you for listening.